Well, everybody gets a treat this morning. You don't have to listen to me. Thanks for the encouragement. That's always good. But Steve Ekman is here. He is the president of York College, and so he has ties to the Lewis family, obviously. I got to hear him speak a couple of years ago up at the Midwest Preachers Retreat up in Wisconsin, and so I enjoyed it thoroughly. And so whenever he called and said that they were going to be in town this weekend for the NAIA National Wrestling Championships and would speak for us if we would like him to, I said, sure. And Mike and Marion thought the same thing. So here he is this morning, and hopefully you'll welcome him. And maybe if you have questions about York, I know he would love to answer those for you. And there's also some materials on the back table that he brought as well. But I'll turn it over to Steve.
Thank you very much, Colby. You know, it's great to be back. I was here when I was in high school to work for Iowa Campaigns for Christ. I don't know if any of you remember that, but that was way back in 1900 and none of your business. I was a little bit younger then. Somebody said, well, I think I recognized you. And I said, well, I don't look the same as I did when I was a sophomore in high school, or for that matter, when I went to college. I've never heard crunchy, crunchy before. I'll have to say that... What number is that in the book? I need to remember when we get back to
728C.
Yeah, well, it's I get to listen to college kids sing every day in chapel, and I enjoy it, but I've not heard anything like that before. So it's, you know, I always like speaking in a new place because I get to tell my favorite preacher story, and believe me, it does have something to do with the lesson. And the reason they call them preacher stories is because they aren't true, and that's, I guess, the way you can get away with it. But the story goes of a young preacher, a guy who wanted to be a preacher back in the 1800s, and he lived in Texas. And the way you became a preacher back then, before we had any of the schools we have now, of course, was that you found an older preacher and you followed him around. You basically became an apprentice or a disciple of an older preacher. You followed him around, listened to his lessons, took notes, adopted a lot of his mannerisms, emulated him in a lot of ways. And so the story is of this... this young guy who follows this older preacher along, and they're in West Texas somewhere. It's in the middle of summer. It's 110 degrees outside. Not a breath of air anywhere. No air conditioning, of course, so the windows are all open on the sides of the church, but it's just not working. Everybody's just burning up hot. And as you women know, the guys start fading first. Their wives try to keep them awake as long as they can, But the husbands start, their eyes start drooping, and pretty soon the women are succumbing too. They're starting to doze off, and their eyes are drooping. And this old preacher looks out over that audience, and he realizes he's about to lose them, so he stops his sermon. And the women start nudging the husbands, and there's a lot of coughing, a lot of throat clearings. Everybody kind of wakes up, and they're kind of looking at him. And then he makes this statement. He says, the best years of my life were spent in the arms of another man's wife. Well, everybody wakes up then. They get on the front of their pew. They're just sitting there with their eyes open, wondering what he's going to say next. And he's got everybody's attention. He says, yes, sir, some of the best years of my life were spent in the arms of my mother, my father's wife. And he went on with his sermon. Well, that young preacher's over here, he just scribbling this down. He said, that's the neatest thing, the neatest technique I've ever heard. He can't wait for the time when he gets to use that. And sure enough, several years later, he's out preaching. He's a new preacher. And he goes to a little congregation. It's hot outside. And as he looks out over that audience, the same thing starts happening. And he's just licking his chops, saying, I can hardly wait. And sure enough, the guys go first. Then the women start following behind. And everybody's kind of drowsy. And he stops his sermon. And he looks out over that audience. And he says, some of the best years of my life were spent in the arms of another man's wife. And same thing happens. Everybody gets on the edge of their pew. The trouble is, when you're a new speaker sometimes, you don't really have all these techniques down. And for the life of him, he couldn't remember what he was supposed to say next. He didn't have it written down, so it wasn't in his notes. And he thought, I don't... And so he's already sweating because of the heat, but now there are tears coming down through the sweat. And he looks out over that audience, and the silence is just getting embarrassing now. And he with tears in his eyes, said, for the life of me, I can't remember who she was. Well, wouldn't you like to always get it right and not make a mistake? I'm sure Colby goes through this. You say something, you think, wait a minute, did I just say what I thought I said, or did I say that wrong? In conversation, have you ever said something and then had to defend a position you thought was wrong, but you'd already said something, so you're kind of stuck in an argument that you really didn't agree on yourself? Am I the only one who's done that? You know, you just say something stupid and you think, why did I say that? You know, the great thing about Jesus, and wouldn't it be great, he never said the wrong thing. He never got it wrong. Now, people may have taken it wrong. They may not like what he said. But, you know, he never has to apologize for getting it wrong or saying the wrong thing. He doesn't chase after the Pharisees and the scribes and say, now, maybe I was a little tough on you guys. You know, maybe you aren't whited sepulchers. Maybe you aren't doing everything wrong like I said you are. He doesn't chase after people and say, oh, I made a mistake in what I said. I shouldn't have said it so forcefully. Because whatever he said was right. And one of the things that he says repeatedly, he doesn't chase after the widow who gives the two mites. And he doesn't say to her, you know, you need that money much more than the temple does. Why don't you let us give you a little something to tide you through? He doesn't say to the rich ruler, you know, maybe selling everything you have and giving to the poor, maybe that's a little steep. Why don't you just get rid of half of it? Let's start there. Let's build up. He doesn't say to his disciples, after he tells them, you're going to suffer and you're going to die and you're going to be persecuted because of me. And he doesn't follow that up in saying, I feel so bad about that. I'm so sorry. Because Jesus realizes something that we as Christians need to learn. And that is, sacrifice is a noble thing. And he would deny no one of its blessing. The passage that was read for us in John chapter 20 is very interesting. I wish I understood everything in that passage. It's one of those ones I keep coming back to because it just seems out of place. But it is the third time in Jesus' ministry that God speaks directly. The first one is at Jesus' baptism. The second one is on the Mount of Transfiguration. And the third one, which I think we largely overlook, is this event in John chapter 12, where the Greeks come up. And I think you have to go to the passage right before this. It says the Pharisees are worried because it looks like the whole world has gone out to follow Jesus. And the next thing we learn is that some Greeks walk up and say, we want to get to know Jesus too. And this seems to trigger something in Jesus. Because he doesn't even talk about seeing the Greeks. He says, it's time for me to be glorified. And God speaks to him and says, you have glorified my name and you will glorify my name. And this seems to be some kind of a marker in Jesus' ministry. But in this discussion, in this passage, he says something that is not just a great phrase or not just a good attitude. It defines the Christian life. He says, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. I want to contend with you today that I think we've missed the point of that passage and we've missed the blessing of sacrifice because as Jesus lays it out for us, he says this is really what it's all about. You know, one of my favorite movies, and I'll have to tell you, I never have liked Jack Nicholson. I don't know why, he just never was someone I liked to watch in movies through the years. Until he made a movie that kind of surprised me, a movie called As Good As It Gets. Have any of you seen As Good As It Gets? Yeah, a few of you, so you can explain to the others. In this story, you've got a guy who is OCD, and he's you know, way off the charts. And his name is Melvin Udall, and the story's about Melvin and Carol the waitress. And Carol the waitress, you know, puts up with this guy who is just always doing these crazy things. Won't step on a crack. He, you know, he has to do everything a certain way. Uses plastic utensils when he comes to the restaurant that she works at, all those kind of things. But the whole point of this story comes down to one moment, really. When they have gone on a trip, and they've gone into a restaurant, And he has had to go buy a coat and a tie and put it on because they won't let him in the restaurant without a coat and a tie. And he comes in and they sit down, and he's always saying the wrong thing. And he says, I don't understand why they make me go get a coat and a tie, but they let you come in wearing that dress. Well, she stands up and says, Melvin, I don't know if you know how much you've hurt me. That's the cruelest thing that you could have said to me, and I'm leaving. And he said, no, don't leave. And she says, unless you pay me a compliment right now, I'm going to leave. And so he gets her to sit down, and he says this to her. I'm going to give you the best compliment I've ever given anybody. There's some medicine that makes me be a little less crazy. And he said, since I've met you, I'm taking that medicine. And she looks at him and says, well, how is that a compliment to me? And he says, since I met you, I want to be a better man. Now, that's kind of the high point of that movie. And it struck me when I saw that and said, you know, I think that's how we've sold Christianity a lot. We've told people, come to church. We have a lot of good people here, and you're going to be a better person for the experience. You come to Hickman Road, and we got people here that will love you, and it's going to be a great experience, and your life will be blessed by this. And that's a great thing, but it's not sacrifice. What is it that makes a person, you know, during World War II, Winston Churchill realizes that they are the last bastion of resistance against the Nazis. And he calls for young men in England to volunteer for the army, and they do so by the millions. And they say, before a bullet enters this country, it's going to have to go through my body. And they give up their lives to defend their country. And Churchill makes that famous statement, we'll fight them in the beaches, we'll fight them in the streets, we'll fight them from house to house, and this will be our finest hour. And it was. Because people stood up and said, I'm willing to die for this. Jesus makes the statement, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it's just a single seed. It's not worth very much. But if it dies, it produces fruit, produces a lot more seeds. And isn't this who Jesus was? Philippians chapter 2. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, didn't count equality with God something to be grasped or hung on to. But he made himself nothing. He made himself nothing. Taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even a death on the cross. Do you realize what that passage is saying? When it says that God made himself nothing, it's not saying that he gave until it hurt. He didn't say that he went the extra mile, that he went beyond his means to give. It says God bankrupted himself. He gave everything he had so that you and I could have eternal life. I don't know how to picture this, really. I mean, I have these fanciful images in my mind, and I think about the angels. You know, we sing the song, He Could Have Called 10,000 Angels. You know that's wrong? Says he could call 10 legion of angels. That'd be 60 to 70,000 angels. How many angels do you think it would take to take care of this world? Maybe one. And Michael, you know, is in charge of the Lord's host. And I have in my mind this picture of these angels sitting at the throne of God. And I don't know how much they know about God's plan. Because, you know, we find out that it hasn't been revealed to the prophets. It hasn't been revealed to the angels. And God is sitting on the throne, and Jesus is down there. And I can see Michael looking at God saying, you see what they're doing? They're smacking him around, and every time they hit him on the face, the universe shakes. And Michael is looking at the throne saying, when are we going to do something about this? And they don't know how to react because this is God, and human beings are destroying him. They're treating him shamefully. And Jesus, as he's nailed to that cross, he looks up at heaven, he says the word Father. I can see 70,000 angels start rising up, pulling swords out of their scabbards, getting ready to just do away with us. And what does Jesus say? Forgive them. They have no idea what they're doing. And 70,000 angels sit back down, and we kill the Son of God. And Jesus says, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it's just a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. You see, this principle is who God is. This principle is who He calls us to be. See, the death of Jesus on the cross wasn't just a good example. It wasn't just something that God did to demonstrate His love to us. It's the nature of God. And He calls us to that same nature. And He says, unless you're willing to die, you'll never truly live. There's so many ways that plays out. I don't think we were designed as Christians to be put in sacks and to sit in a warehouse. And isn't that kind of what church is? I mean, we come and we worship together. We look at the back of each other's heads. Take as small a piece of the Lord's bread as we can. And we kind of go through the motions. But it's supposed to be something bigger than that. What happens here is preparing us to go out and plant ourselves and to die. And we need to die to each other. You know, sometimes in the church, I see such petty little arguments turn into big issues. Because people get their egos involved and they get their thought process involved, and they don't realize it's not about what I want or what I think ought to happen or what I'm convinced of. It's about God and what He does. And Jesus says, unless you die, this thing will never take off. It will never grow. It will never get any bigger unless people in this church see someone willing to die to themselves. Promote them. I remember I was preaching at a congregation. We had our 75th anniversary. And, you know, we'd done the typical things. We got all the former preachers up. We got all the former elders up. And a lady came and said, well, my husband and I, you know, I made him come because he used to be a deacon here. And the only reason we came was to get recognized. When are you going to recognize the deacons? And I felt bad for her, but I just wanted to shake my head and said, it's not about that. That same church, we remodeled the auditorium. You know, there are people who went to another congregation because we picked the wrong color for the pews? What in the world are we about? Jesus said, unless you're willing to die, your influence is just going to be worthless. But if it dies, if you die, you produce many seeds. How does that play out? I think in the world in which we live, you know, I read stories of great sacrifice. There's a story about some missionaries who went to it back in the 1800s, went to a Tangier leper colony. And they got to the border and they found out as they couldn't go into the colony because once you got in there, you couldn't come out again. And so instead of abandoning their mission, they got their families together. They had a worship service. They prayed for each other. They went into the colony and were never heard from again. Story of some missionaries in China back around the turn of 1900s who were on a boat and were going to do mission work in China, and they got there and they found out that China wouldn't let them in. And one of them snuck ashore at night and he came back to the boat and he said, I found out how we can get in. And they went into China and sold themselves as slaves. their families never heard from them again. Unless you're willing to die, are you really going to be able to make it? And they didn't do it. So somebody put their name on a board somewhere and praised them because of what they did, because they're willing to die. How often are we willing to die for our families? And I guess I'm talking to men here, because it seems like women are a lot more sacrificial in a family relationship than men are. I remember raising my boys, who are now men themselves, and thinking about all the great times. You know, when they were very young, I appreciate the young kids in this congregation. It always makes my heart feel good to see young people in a church. But I remember my wife and I talking about the experiences we were going to have that were going to be meaningful to these boys as they were growing up. And, you know, maybe parents, you're like this too. Looking back on some of those experiences, for example, the vacation where we went to the Grand Canyon, and all the stuff that we stopped to see, and I realized that the two guys in the back of the car weren't on the same vacation my wife and I were on. You know, what they were talking about is the games that they played, and my, you know, remember that's when Jeremy threw up in the back seat? Well, yeah, and that wasn't that important for me to remember, but that's what they remember. And we were on two separate trips. But I think about all the things I wanted to have happen, but because I probably wasn't humble enough and sacrificial enough, all those great opportunities, you know, about lessons in life, and then I realized how many times we just sat and watched TV, or fought over who had control of the remote, or, you know, all those times that just went by us, and we didn't have those great moments, because I, as a father, was not willing to die to my family. You know, we got the church and we got our family, just other Christians. There's a story. There's a book out called The Life You've Always Wanted by a guy named John Ortberg. And I encourage you, if you ever get that book, to read the first chapter, maybe the first two, and then forget the rest of it, because the rest of it's not that good. But he has this story as he talks about living the kind of life we wanted and how meaningful it can be. And he tells the story of Mabel. The story is about a young man named Tom Smith who was going to college, and as part of his college requirements, he was asked on a Mother's Day to go and hand out flowers at a rest home. And he did this just as an assignment, and let me read you some of this. As I neared the end of this hallway, I saw an old woman strapped up in a wheelchair. Her face was an absolute horror. The empty stare and the white pupils of her eyes told me that she was blind. The large hearing aid over one ear told me she was almost deaf. One side of her face was being eaten by cancer. There was a discolored and running sore covering part of one cheek. It had pushed her nose to one side, dropped one eye, and distorted her jaw. As a consequence, she drooled constantly. I was told later that when new nurses arrived, they always send her to feed this woman, thinking if she could stand this sight, she could stand anything in the building. Tom Smith said, I put a flower in her hand, and I said, Happy Mother's Day. I didn't expect a response. Her garbled words reflected a clear mind as she said, Thank you. I'm sure it's lovely, but can I give it to someone else? I can't see it, you know, because I'm blind. Tom pushed her down the hall. They found another patient. And Mabel, handing the flower over, said, Here, this is from Jesus. Tom was just struck by that. Here's a woman who's 89 years old. She'd been in the convalescent home for 25 years. A big part of that time, sitting at the end of a hall with no one talking to her. She can't read. She can't watch television. Just in her own closed-in world. And so Tom started going to see her once or twice a week. The rest of the time he was in college. And one day as he's getting ready for an exam, he's really engaged in studying for this exam, and he's all of a sudden it hits him. What does Mabel think about all day? just sitting there by herself with no stimulation, nothing to really, no one paid any attention to her. And so the next time he was there, he said, "Mabel, what do you think about all day?" And here's her response. "I think about Jesus. He's been so good to me. 25 years sitting in a chair in a rest home." She said, "Most people don't think much of my opinion and want to know what I think. But I think about Jesus because He's everything I have now." And she started singing that garbled voice, "Jesus is all the world to me, my life, my friend, my all. He is my strength from day to day. Without Him, I would fall." And Tom is just blown away. Here is a woman who doesn't have anything to give, but she gives it. And that's all she cares about. What about as we encounter others? One of my favorite stories, it's called Baby Eric and the Old Man. Don't know if you've heard it, but I really like what it says. We were the only family with children in the restaurant. I sat Eric in a high chair and noticed everyone was quietly eating and talking. Suddenly, Eric squealed with glee. And he said, "Hi there." He pounded his fat baby hands on the high chair tray. His eyes were wide with excitement, and his mouth was bared in a toothless grin. He wriggled and giggled with merriment. I looked around to see the source of the merriment. It was a man with a tattered rag of a coat, dirty, greasy, and worn. His pants were baggy with a zipper at half-mast. His toes poked out of would-be shoes. His shirt was dirty. His hair was uncombed and unwashed. His whiskers were too short to be called a beard, and his nose was so varicose it looked like a roadman. We were too far away from him to smell, but I was sure that he smelled bad too. His hands waved and flapped on loose wrists. "Hi there, baby. Hi, big boy. I see you, Buster," the man kept saying to Eric. My husband and I just looked at each other. What were we going to do? Eric, of course, continued to laugh and to answer, "Hi, hi." Everyone in the restaurant noticed and looked at us and then looked at the man. The old geezer was creating a nuisance with my beautiful baby. Our meal came and the man began shouting from across the room, "Hey, baby, do you know how to play patty cake? Do you know how to play peekaboo? Peekaboo! Look, everybody, he knows how to play peekaboo." Nobody thought the old man was cute. He was obviously drunk. My husband and I were embarrassed. We ate in silence, all except, of course, for Eric, who was running through his repertoire of skills for the admiring Skid Row bum, who in turn kept reciprocating with his cute comments. Our meal was ruined. We finally got through the meal and headed for the door. My husband went to pay the check and told me to meet him in the parking lot. I looked up, and the old man was poised between me and the door. "Lord, just let me get out of here before he speaks to me or Eric," I prayed. As I drew close to the man, I turned my back, trying to sidestep him and avoid any air that he might be breathing. As I did, Eric leaned over my arm, reaching with both arms in a baby's pick-me-up position. Before I could stop him, Eric had propelled himself from my arms to the man's. Suddenly, a very old, smelly man and a very young baby consummated their love relationship. Eric, in an act of total trust, love, and submission, laid his tiny head on the man's ragged shoulder. The man's eyes closed, and I saw tears hover beneath the lashes. His aged hands, full of grime, pain, hard labor, gently, so gently, cradled my baby's bottom, stroked his back. I doubt whether two beings have ever loved so deeply for so short a time. I stood awestruck. The old man rocked and cradled Eric in his arms for a moment. Then his eyes opened. He set them squarely on mine, and he said in a firm and a commanding voice, "You take care of this baby." Somehow I managed. I will. From a throat that contained a stone. He pried Eric from his chest, unwillingly, longingly, as if it hurt. I received my baby, and the man said, "God bless you, ma'am. You've given me a wonderful gift." I said nothing more than a muttered thanks. With Eric in my arms, I ran for the car. My husband was wondering why was I crying and holding Eric so tight, and why I kept saying over and over again, my God, forgive me." You see, I just witnessed Christ's love shown through the innocence of a tiny child who saw no sin, made no judgment. A child who saw a soul being held by a mother who saw a suit of clothes. I was a Christian who was blind, holding a baby who was not. I felt like God was asking me, "Are you willing to share your son for a few minutes?" I shared mine for eternity. God was willing to bankrupt himself. Because the principle is that unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, unless it sacrifices, it's just a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Do you know why the church doesn't grow? It's not because our techniques are wrong. It's not because we don't understand Scripture. It's because we aren't willing to sacrifice. Jesus didn't just give us an example. He said, "This is who I am, and this is who I call you to be." Unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, unless you and I die to ourselves, other people will never know God, never know about Jesus. I don't know where you are in your walk. I know I think about this a lot. What am I willing to give up? And it keeps coming down to, what am I willing to do? And God says, there's nothing about you in this equation. It's all about me. And Jesus said, "I'll give up everything if it will bring people to God." Wherever you are on that walk, God continually calls us to sacrifice, to plant ourselves, because others won't grow until we die. If you're subject to the Lord's invitation, we invite you to come. We stand and sing.